What's it like to play on centre court in front of you know who?
Well, I mean, this is... I mean, it's probably the first time he's watching me and I won the match. Really. The last couple I lost, so good to break the curse. No, it's great, obviously. Great to have Roger, you know, huge champion and someone that I admired and respected a lot. You know, we've shared the stage for so many years and it's great to have him back in his most successful and his favorite tournament, no doubt.
Novak Djokovic comes back to win in his match yesterday. He continues. He is the second favorite right now on the betting odds to win on the men's side at Wimbledon behind Carlos Alcaraz. Jeremy and Joe, Jeremy's off today. Morning. It's cloudy. Gonna be a nice day, though. Low 70s and sunny. On the Western Hotline now, Ed McGrogan from the Tennis Channel, who we've had on in the past, big Bills fan as well. Ed, are you in England?
I am in New England. How about that?
New England.
I'm watching grass tennis, but it is not at Wimbledon. Not to go too deep into the woods, but there's what I would call like a triple A event in Newport, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. So I'm over here actually covering that and Wimbledon at the same time. But kind of feels like I'm in England in a way.
Yeah. Eugenie Bouchard, I just saw on your Twitter, was at Newport. So a couple of big names maybe at that tournament. So keeping up with Wimbledon, we'll get to some Bills as well with you because I thought to bring you on. You were tweeting about our conversation from yesterday about the one seed and whatnot. But to start with the tennis and to start with Wimbledon, there's Djokovic there speaking. He comes back to win. At 38, I always tie him together as everyone probably does with Federer, Nadal, all kind of playing in the same era. Is him playing this well at this age, is he starting to separate from the other two just on that part of it, the longevity?
You know, you could see him. I sort of can see how Djokovic's end game goes here. Like, you know, he is more susceptible to injury. There is the slowdown that Federer and Nadal both had. But it was, to your point, a little more stark with Roger and Rafa. And I think this does give, you know, there's a big conversation, there always has been, about who is the tennis men's GOAT, Roger, Rafa, Novak. They all have their backers. They all have their hardcore fans. And I think, you know, especially if he is to, you know, bag another slam here, maybe even at Wimbledon, it's, you know, kind of another feather in the cap of the Djokovic camp there. He really struggled at the beginning of this year. He wasn't even winning matches, really. And I thought, you know, this could take a downturn in a pretty severe way. But right before the French Open, he won what was his 100th career tournament, a pretty small event. But that got him going. He had a very nice Roland Garros, you know, even pushed Sinner there. And what he's doing now is what he's done for essentially his whole career. He is peaking at Wimbledon. And it would be still a stretch, perhaps, to beat Alcaraz or Sinner, which I'm sure a lot of listeners maybe got their first real looks at during the French Open, considering that final. But, you know, Novak's kind of playing with house money right now, and that's a very dangerous thing, especially for a player who, throughout his career, has done his best when he's kind of doubted, really.
Yeah, him going back and forth with Alcaraz a couple years ago is how I discovered Alcaraz. That match was unbelievable. On that GOAT conversation, is that just relentless in tennis? Is it like three Michael Jordans who all existed at the same time and everyone's got their guy?
It's, you know, it's so unique because they all more or less peaked and played at the exact same time. You know, Federer finished at 20 slams. Nadal 22, Djokovic 24, and for a little bit of a time, they all had 20 at the very same time. So not only is it this, it's not this artificial debate where you're comparing eras, which is really the biggest hang-up in a lot of the sports GOAT conversations. They were quite literally all playing that level at once. So it's something that I think even a lot of Federer and Nadal fans have conceded to Djokovic. The longevity, the quantity is just there. I think everybody's going to have their favorites. I mean, I was a rabid Roger fan. That's kind of how I got into the sport in a big way. But I obviously, you know, understand and see just how much Djokovic has done. So I think that's, you know, you're talking earlier about what the biggest stories are for Wimbledon. And certainly where, if we get this rematch between Alcaraz and Sinner, is going to be a major highlight. But I think the biggest story really is, can Djokovic, at perhaps one of his last great chances, get this 25th slam? And I think, you know, that's going to be just as significant as anything else that could happen at the All England Club.
Ed McGrogan with us on the Western Hotline Tennis Channel. You mentioned him running into Alcaraz, though, or even Sinner. Would you think that if he does play either one of those, that, especially Alcaraz, that he would fall short?
I mean, I think he's clearly he's a clear underdog in those matches, despite his history at this tournament. They're, you know, Alcaraz and Sinner right now, they are just they're peaking as well, which is a problem for him and pretty much everybody else in the field. You know, I think a good way to illustrate it was yesterday. Sinner was down two sets to Grigor Dimitrov, and he escaped after Dimitrov had to retire, of all things, with an injury. Mm-hmm. And I looked up the money line that at the end of the second set, where Sinner's, again, down two sets, he's only plus 100, even down two sets.
Down two sets? Five. Wow.
Yeah, down two sets. He was still almost minus money for the money line. Wow. That's how impressive these two are and how much they've separated from everyone. So Djokovic, I think, you know, the proverbial thing, kind of has to play the match of his life. The thing against him that was so helpful for him for so many years is it's best of five. He would have to take, you know, the three sets against either of these two guys. And that, for so long, was Djokovic's calling card, is he could outlast anybody in this extended format at the majors for the men. So, you know, I wouldn't count on it, but I would love to see, you know, him have that, because I think he would throw everything, you know, everything he could at it. This and, you know, you could say the U.S. Open are his chances. It remains to be seen. You know, he hasn't mentioned anything about retirement, but you could certainly kind of read the tea leaves that this feels like, you know, really the last chapter of his amazing career.
And the new chapter for, I mean, maybe you'll tell me that I should put Sinner in this category too, but Carlos Alcaraz being only 22, do you feel like he is well on his way to having a career like the three that we've been talking about, Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic?
He's a bona fide clear number one. He's technically number two in the rankings right now behind Sinner. But what I would say is that to put him where I'm going to say he's going to get 15 to 20 majors, you can't say that about anybody, even Carlos Alcaraz right now. That is just, if that's a leap too far to go. But if you do look at the trajectories of where he is, I think he is, I think as his slam count at his age, he's essentially on Rafa's pace. He would just have to, again, have the longevity that these guys did. And that's almost as unlikely as the talent that they showed is in a sport where it's played from January to October. It doesn't really end ever. They were just relentless at the top. So Alcaraz has impressed me and really everybody else so much with how much he's done in such a quick amount of time. You know, to say that he's absolutely going to ascend to that like level of them is a lot to ask, but it's fascinating to watch because, you know, I think he has some qualities of all three of those players. And that, I think, is why he's become so captivating so quickly.
Ed McGrogan on the Western Hotline. What about on the women's side for Wimbledon? How much air did it take out of the sails of the storylines and the potential attention maybe that side got when Coco Gauff and Jesse Pegula went out as early as they did?
Yeah, I was obviously going to bring up Jesse with the audience here. That was a really, really not a great match from her in her first rounder, which is a bit surprising in her career. She's really been a bigger tournament, bigger match player. This year, she's actually been very good outside of the slams, has titles on all three surfaces, nearly won Miami, which is one of the, you know, I'd say the fifth or sixth biggest tournament on the calendar. But she's really struggled to all the slams. And this Wimbledon loss, was a really, you know, it was under an hour. It just did not look like her at all. She also came off a French Open loss to a player, Luis Boisson, who was ranked in the 300s, kind of caught fire. Even Boisson even made the semifinals, but Jessie just hasn't had that run at the slams. You know, the U.S. Open is where she'll obviously try to go, defending her finals points there. And then for Coco, yeah, this was this was just like the first 2 days were historically ridden with upsets. Coco was, you know, coming off the French Open win. I think where we are at this point is just, you know, it feels like it is anybody's tournament to win. But if you look at the draw, I mean, there are still some massive names in the women's event. Now, Sabalenka is currently trailing in the first set of her match right now. But I picked Iga Swiatek to win this for the first time before the tournament, and I think things could be shaping up for her as well. So despite that, you know, day one, day two carnage, which it was, you know, it was widespread. And losing Coco, especially to a U.S. viewing audience, at this time of year, like Wimbledon, I say this about tennis a lot, Wimbledon benefits so much from the U.S. sports calendar having essentially nothing on right now. I'm thumbing through the guide and it's like there's regular season baseball, there's softball, we're itching up for Little League World Series. Like, everything else has kind of gone by the wayside. Tennis really does get its moment, I would say, almost even more than the U.S. Open. And to lose Coco that early, you know, a tough blow, I think, to those audiences, but it's still a very strong tournament where we are now.
Yeah, we cannot wait for training camp. That's the point in the calendar that we're at. I said something earlier, maybe this was yesterday, about how Coco and Jessie Pegula going out kind of took, like, especially for me, like I'm watching the women's side right now, but those are the two that I'm dialed into the most. And a listener passed along that, and what Mira Andreeva, there's an 18-year-old that's also in the women's side too, that maybe is someone that's worth following.
So she could be, you know, I'm not going to compare her to Alcaraz or Sinner, but I think the breakout young star potential is if this becomes the tournament she wins. So Mira Andreeva, yes, a teenage player from Russia. She won the Indian Wells tournament, which is, I would say, the biggest tournament after the majors this past year. And she has kind of that young firepower and has really competed admirably with Sabalenka, with Swiatek, with players like that. So that's, you know, if you're talking about like your underground tennis knowledge for like the very casual fan, Andreeva is someone that I don't think too many people who, unless they follow the sport, are going to know that well, but she has a tremendous chance to reach the final, actually. She is playing tomorrow against Belinda Bencic. That's a veteran player, but it's a very winnable match for her. Iga and Andreeva is probably a likely semifinal. So I think, yeah, you definitely want to like watch her game. Just it's a very powerful game and just really still coming into its own. But someone that I think if she plays, let's say, a Sabalenka in the final, that's like probably your most hard-hitting, contentious match that could come with a women's draw right here. Iga and Arena Sabalenka have a huge rivalry of their own, but I think a lot of people like in the tennis world are waiting for Andreeva to have that massive Grand Slam breakthrough. And yeah, I think the caller makes a good point there.
Yeah. Before we let you go, I want to get your thoughts on this Bills season. You tweeted at me yesterday because we were talking about the importance of the regular season, and for some it's not. Like, for some it's just get me to January, whatever it is, and let's see how the cards fall. For me, man, the one seed is the thing they have not done, and yesterday we really realized, putting it on paper, the difference in your path to the Super Bowl, whether you have it or not. So, I don't know, for you, this Bills regular season, how invested, how important do you think it is for them to wrestle that one seed away from Kansas City and Baltimore?
So I love when you put that up, because I've said the same thing about the one seed. That is, it's the obvious thing that they haven't done. I feel like we're in 2022 again. And I get that because you're coming off of a year where Josh makes a huge leap. So 2021, that's, of course, the 13 seconds a game. Josh has that ascent. The team, you know, consensus title contender. I think the vibes are pretty strong there. So, like, I feel like we're back at that path. That was actually one of my favorite seasons to watch. Now, we know how that ended with Hamlin and then the Cincinnati game, but kind of remember how that season started. You had, that was, I think they played the Rams in the opener after the Rams in the Super Bowl. They, you know, after that, there's a couple big games. I think they flattened Tennessee. They get a regular season win over Kansas City. Like, they started incredibly well. They end up finishing 13-3 too. And the point I raised on your tweet, which was, you know, if everybody else didn't see it, it's the Bills essentially have to get through two of three of KC, Baltimore, Cincinnati all the time because they cannot get this one seed. And when I look back at that year, I think of that Minnesota game, which I was at, of course, and that's that, you know, improbable 38 things had to happen and they all happened and they lose that game. And if you have to make a bit of a stretch here, but if they win that and things play out the way they do, they get the one seed. And I think from there, it's like, obviously the chances are greater. Anything can happen there. So I think this year, like, to me, the regular season is important still. Like, it, in other sports, you know, there is just so many games. They still do matter in a 17 game season. And I think, you know, to get that one, and, you know, if you want to play the easy schedule card, certainly the Bills probably have some advantages over other teams. I think they know it too. I feel like it has been an unspoken thing for a little while, but I think it's being more vocalized too a bit. I think even McDermott and Bean have mentioned it. I think that one seed's vital. And, you know, the last year of the stadium too, you add all that in. I'm excited for that part of it. And I think they all know this is, again, one of those moments where try to strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah, I really think it's set up for them. It's the schedule point, and part of this is the schedule point, but I just don't feel like there's any real threat to the Bills in their own division, and I feel that way about both the others. Like, I think Baltimore is going to have Cincinnati to deal with, maybe Pittsburgh. I don't think Pittsburgh, but some do. And then I'm starting to fall for Denver a little bit, and I know the Chargers actually are the team that gets more hype, but Denver's got a roster. Like, their defense is good. It's just going to come down to how good can that quarterback be. So either way, though, like, Broncos, Chargers, you would both rank them above, I think, either of the Dolphins or the Patriots. So the division slate sets up well. I just feel like this is the year that it all kind of falls together. Schedule, division, their road opponents are super easy. Like, I think the Bills kind of, if they're ever going to do it, it feels like it's got to happen now.
I think I was saying earlier, what are the odds the Bills have a better road record than a home record at the end of this year?
Like, I mean,
it's in play,
yeah.
Considering just where they all are. I think they have four or five at home to start. But yeah, it really does. And I think, you know, I think we'll see it right away. I think if the urgency is there off the top, it's not like they're not going to, I'm not saying like they're tempering things as they start the year, but you know, the other thing is if you can build that kind of cushion early, then you are potentially able to, you know, ease a little bit by the end. You know, you're catching Philly week 17. I know that was a bizarre scheduling slot there. I mean, so I think there's a lot in their favor that can, you know, go this way. And I think it just, you know, it is one of those things where I think the regular season in kind of an odd way does matter so much to their postseason hopes.
You're going to get up to the stadium this year for the final season?
This year we are going to bring my son James to his first game. I think that was going to be the red and blue practice, actually.
Okay.
When we get their preseason, I will definitely be up for Tampa Bay in November with my Buffaloed crew. And then obviously, you know, do the preseason, do the regular season, got to do the postseason too. So
nice.
I'll be up there a couple times.
Nice. Tampa will be a good, that'll be a good game. I think the Bucs are pretty good. But also the Bills will be favored, I'm sure, by a lot in that game. Ed McGrogan on Twitter, if you want to follow him there. That is his handle, at Ed McGrogan. And a lot of good stuff, of course, throughout Wimbledon here. So thanks, Ed, for coming on, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks. Get Nate to talk some tennis sometime. Do get him back on.
Definitely. Definitely will. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks.
Wimbledon, by the way, right now as we are talking, Sabalenka is down 5-2 in her first set, number one seed on the women's side. And they are, 5-2. Thought it was the end of a point. In favor of Siegmund, who is that's the German tennis player that Coco Gauff went off on last year because she takes forever to play. Like every point is like a full minute getting ready before she ends up, serving. So that match is going on right now. Alcaraz is playing, I think, at 9:30. So 10 o'clock. Thanks, Josh. And he's, to me, the biggest draw in the whole thing right now. 803-0550 is the phone number. Revisit our James Cook conversation from earlier. We never really did fully rank him. Where's he rank? All-time Bills running back list. I don't think he's on the Mount Rushmore. Or even in that conversation. Thurman, OJ, Fred Jackson, and who's the fourth? If you would even give me Fred, who's the fourth? Could it be LeSean McCoy?
I wonder about the longevity, though.
It was 4 years, right? Like, that's actually more than a lot of these guys. It's more than McGahee. It's more than... it's the same as Travis Henry, and he was more productive through that fourth year. So, yeah, I hear you, but... There's not many guys that go longer than 4 years.
Right. I mean, how long are you looking to get out of a running back for them to be great? I think McCoy was awesome when he was here, and
first 3 years he was great.
Like it was that fourth super
year
fun.
Was that fourth year was pretty tough. 3.2 yards per carry, 500 yards.
Right. He did fall off a cliff.
But the first three were great.
Those were I mean, there was nothing else going on. Like that was the shady show.
And does he get extra points for? Like, he's definitively is he the best player on the team that breaks the drought?
Gotta be, right?
Maybe Micah Hyde is better. Best player on that side of the ball. He was the best player on offense when they broke the drought, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of says a lot about that team and why, maybe they were a little lucky to get in because their running back was their best offensive player. But, I've got the yards. I've got 4 years, I've got breaking the drought.
He's also like a he speaks very highly of the team now.
Oh, wait. Yeah.
Super, loves Josh Allen. So should that matter? I don't know. Maybe not, but it kind of does, I think.
Sorry, this is also my youth getting to me where Cookie Gilchrist has to be in the top four.
Oh, yes.
He or Joe Cribbs. Like, you gotta respect the history of the team.
Yeah, sorry, everybody.
Cookie Gilchrist had 31 touchdowns in 3 years for the Bills.
That's insane.
It's two-time first-team All-Pro, one-time second-team All-Pro in those 3 years. It was only 3 years, but...
I mean, yeah, but McCoy, we just said that about McCoy.
Right, like, McCoy's fourth year was 500 yards and 3 yards a carry. I almost don't even want to count that.
Doesn't matter.
So, Gilchrist. Maybe Joe Cribbs, but it probably would be... The conversation would be between those two if we're doing a Mount Rushmore for the Bills running backs.
McCoy led the 2017 Bills in touchdowns, by the way.
Yep.
Eight total touchdowns, six rushing, two receiving.
Yep. I might put him fifth or sixth. Not fourth, though. 803-0550 is the phone number here on WGR.